ISKCON founder Sri Bhaktivedanta Swami Sri Prabhupada Ki. All glories to the Assembly of Devotees. All glories to the Assembly of Devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Sri Guranga. Oh, Premahananda Hari Bhari Hari Bo. So I want to continue with our series of discussions from our latest book, Die Before Dying. Today I'm going to discuss kind of a misnomer, and in that misnomer, we're going to look at being alone. Now, we're never really alone, if you think about it. And why? Why is it that we're never categorically alone, even when we appear or seem to be alone? Krishna's in the heart, especially, yes. Sarvas jaham sannivisto mataksmiti agyanam apavanam cha vedishtyasva maham veda yobananta kriyat veda veda eva chaham. Krishna says distinctly, I'm there, hiding, but in everyone's heart. And I'm the energizer, because from me is coming the knowledge, wisdom, and from me also is coming the forgetfulness. So the Lord is responsible for the knowledge that comes to us, and also for the nations that we solicit based on our desires and attitude and aspirations. We're never alone. Also, as we enter into this universe, Super Soul comes and Shastra is there, sadhus are there, all kinds of opportunities for sanghas. Now, normally we talk a lot about community, and we speak about the importance of understanding ourselves in relationship to community. And today we're going to do something seemingly different and talk about the individual or being alone, because so many of the most important things we do alone. We do certain things with community really to prepare us and to help us with what we have to do when we're so-called by ourselves. People come together in their mosques, their churches, their shrines, their temples, and they congregate in these sanghas. The Buddhists, they worship sangha as we do. We very much worship sangha. We realize that so much of our devotional life is based on the kind of associations that we have. The quality of association, it determines, you know, so much. As a matter of fact, you can know someone so much based on, you know, on the company that he or she keeps. It's just natural. If you're a drug addict, you're going to find a certain amount of fraternity and sorority with other drug addicts. If you're a sportsman, a musician, a politician, a doctor, you just naturally have a certain kind of association with those who are your peers, your colleagues in your profession, or who are accepting the same kind of lifestyle. Because so much of what you are about is also what they're about, but also your associating with them helps to validate who you are and what you're doing. It's like in the Shusha Upanishad, we have the Ishavasha conception, Ishavasha Idam Sarvam. Or as Vaishnavas, we have Dasu Daso Nudasa. So our idea of ourselves is in relationship to trying to be the servant of the servant. We value life so much based on how we are being able to accept and to make impact as being the servant of the servant. In South Africa, they have something very interesting called the Ubuntu principle, which emphasizes that one sees themselves in relationship to community and in relationship to God. And so an individual evaluates him or her existence based on what they're offering and what they're receiving, you know, from community. And if we look at ancient cultures, we look at, you know, at village life, doesn't matter what part of the world, India, Latin America, South America, Africa, etc., we'll see this kind of, you know, mood of individuals being so concerned about what role they play in community. So we've talked about community as having three major C's: of communication, of cooperation, and also of communion. So without cooperation, there's no community, or is pseudo community. There'd be certain things that people are having as mission and a vision, and they're seeing as their purpose for being in association. Because we have the different tenets of what constitutes as kind. We have tremendous shastra. We're to be shastra shakshus, to better evaluate things and see things through the eyes of the shastra. And without open communications, honest communications, then people are not able to kind of check in on each other and see what is to be done and how it is to be done, and how, and they're not able to have sufficient, you know, honest evaluation. Feedback is very important. And being a servant of the servant, we call each other Prabhu, meaning we see others as our masters. We are even more concerned, not only trying to be our neighbor's keeper, but how to be so available that even the neighbor doesn't have to ask. And without communion, some scholars, things that we do in terms of festivals, in terms of our bhajans and kirtans, and all of this is part of our deity service, where we engage in the savior of different types of worship. So this is, you know, this is community. But today we're going to look at being alone, which is a misnomer because we're never alone, but we're going to discuss it this way. But maybe a better word would be solo. Now, if you think of solo, some of you are musicians, some of you sing, singers, some sportsmen. These are sometimes good examples. So, you've seen major concert, and many people are playing, many people are singing, but then someone steps up to the microphone and does solo. So they're alone, but they're not alone. At that time, all eyes and ears are on them. And whatever they do, it's grand, and any mistake they make is going to be noticed because they're alone. They're doing solo. They're running track and as a team, but at some point each team player is doing solo. They have to perform according to their own talents. Others are there watching and cheering them on, but the person has to do his or her, you know, share. Now, an interesting thing about solo that sometimes we can hide when we are in the group, and what we're not so expert in or what we're not so clear about, it doesn't show. And sometimes people do this. They kind of hide behind institutions, they hide behind, you know, positions, and sometimes they're not even aware of where they may be weak, or sometimes they're not even aware of how strong they are that they have to do solo. So Krishna arranges in different ways that we have to do solo. Although we are never alone, but many times things take on that particular air and appearance. And death is surely one of those. We know that the time of death, according to our consciousness, determines where the soul goes. We understand the associations that we've had and the things that have been important to us, things we've processed, according to our mindset, that is going to be activated at the last moments when the body is, when the soul is leaving, you know, the body. And so all of those impressions and aggregations are part of what happens in community, in associations. When that, you know, that musician or singer now stands up and sings, or stands up and plays the flute, and everyone is watching them, listening to them, and the lights are on them, and their supporters are behind, maybe in the background, but everything now is focused on that person. And at that moment, the success, or perhaps even a failure, is be attributed to that particular person. Imagine there's this beautiful, beautiful group of people, wonderful, wonderfully talented, and then one person gets up and does solo and just embarrasses everyone. It just puts a bad light on the entire concert. How many wonderful things may have been done before then, someone does that and it just throws things out. Maybe even for a while, it may take the whole group a while, you know, to get balanced. And what to say of the person who made that mistake? Sometimes they're traumatized for the rest of their life. Every time they get ready to call to do a solo, no way. Or they're reflecting back to, you know, what previously happened. So we see when we are alone, we think we're alone. It's like when a little child is with the parents and maybe they're in the mall or somewhere, and somehow the kid, you know, seemingly gets lost. The child panics, screams, cries. Or there's some place and they're playing, and they look around and they don't see, you know, mother or daddy, and they freak out. So just to think about being alone, it's very taxing, and sometimes it's very frightening. And sometimes people really have a tremendous phobia about being alone, and they sort of plan their lives in such a way that basically they're almost never alone. And when they're in the house and they're alone, they turn on the TV, even though they may not be watching it, just to have something going on, to hear voices, to feel, you know, some type of presence. Because we are social beings. And we are designed for interesting sanghas, that sambandha relationships is an integral part of reality. We're not having those, or we're not thinking that we're having those. It produces a problem in our consciousness. Now, I'm beginning to understand better and better how much we're not alone, how much the Lord is calling out and making things available, but how expert the living entity finds a way to try to get around or to not to hear, or we say pashana pina pashati, to see and at the same time not to see. Something is there and it's available for perception, but also there has to be the desire to want to perceive. And so Krishna arranges so many things, but still there has to be desire to want to accept and to internalize. We all have guides. We all have helpers. Our major helper, of course, is the Lord Himself, the Paramatma, who's in everyone's heart. But just like the principal or the rector or the president of a university or the governor or the president of a country doesn't do everything him or herself, it does not expect to do all kinds of micromanagement, but they have all kinds of assistance. So Krishna, controlling everything, hamsa vasa pavabho mataksa vambhavadita iti mata vajangte imam buddha bhava samambhataha, that is material and the spiritual arenas, he doesn't do everything in terms of micromanaging every little aspect, even though he's aware and involved and sensitive, and ultimately his energy is responsible, but he has many different kinds of agents. It's like we have in our different societies, we have postman, we have policeman, we have soldier. So there are certain kinds of positions that people can occupy for particular designated types of services. So there are some beings, there are some yogis, there are some rishis, there are some saints who have specific duties in monitoring the lives of entities on this planet and assisting. There are certain kinds of yogis and saints who are very, very active, that we perceive, and they're physical, and we associate with them in our own sanghas. We should always look for higher association. But there's also helpers that we most of the time do not see, unless we, of course, are having being blessed or endowed, you know, with higher vision. It's like how once Prabhupada was chanting and smiling and in a particular direction, and later devotees were inquiring, and Prabhupada had mentioned how Narada Muni had come to the Sangha. We say all glories to the assembly of devotees. When we end our prayers and songs, we're really saying all glories to those of us who have assembled, who we physically see and are experiencing the sweetness of togetherness, and all glories to those who have joined us. Because when the quality of the Sangha is very profound, it will draw others who want to be a part of that level of experience. And so sometimes very evolved beings will come in and out of associations where there is strong cries for devotion, intensity of devotion, and where there is receptivity. But literally each of us have amazing helpers. This is, we have some friends, you know, who are always there for us. But all of us, we have. The Lord would never be harsh, insensitive, cruel, and send jivas into such a hellish environment. The material universes are very hellish environments, where all kinds of illicit activities go on, where the basic norms, the normative patterns are designed to keep the person in prison, and where especially in Kali Yuga, that the deviations are stronger than the piety. A leader would be cruel to send someone into an environment where there's no chance of them to be able to succeed, or there's no facility to help them to be able to succeed. So this death experience is an experience where the consciousness comes forth according to what the previous associations have been, what has been internalized, and also after all that's done, one seemingly has to do solo, although even at that point they're helpers. Just like before I came back to, you know, to U.S. Well, to the mainland, because I was in Hawaii, and at one point my illness had gotten so intense. I've been in the hospital two times. I went in again, emergency, and stayed for a couple of days. And when I came back to the house, I got out of the truck and I made a few steps in the living room, you know, and then I collapsed. And so that day, that night, I called Ekavira and Vajalila in, and I said, I think I'm going to leave. And so I gave them some seemingly last instructions. Because at that point, I prayed to Prabhupada that it's my preference at this point to go. I don't think I can endure the degree of what I'm having to experience. Where normally my prayer had always been, whatever your desire is. Now, I made that prayer, but I also included my normal prayer, whatever your desire is. My preference is, I want to get out of here now. But if it's still not time, it is not your desire, then let it be. Whatever has to be experienced. I mean, at this point here, you know, we tried so many things. I went to Mexico so many weeks, and then to Hawaii, and somehow at some point the treatments weren't working, and I gone to the allopathic hospital again, third time, I stayed, blood transfusions, just got out, and I was so weak, I just collapsed. And I thought, okay, all right, so time to go. Now that night, And just to emphasize, again, solo and community and helpers. So I considered, good chance I'm not going to wake up. So I was quite ready, if that was, to be. So that night, two entities, two beings, one on the right, one on the left, just seemed to approach the bed and stayed at my bed. And at some point, an angelic entity, like a Gandharva, flew in over the bed and reached out, seemingly to pull me out of the body or assist me. So I was getting ready to reach out also. And I thought, let me call Ekavir and let him know that I'm going. They're going to be too overwhelmed and disturbed, because I was thinking, although I've told them that I'm probably going to be leaving, I don't think they really accepted it. So let me just let them know I'm gone now. You know, it's real. And I tried to call him, and I couldn't, you know. We've all had experiences when you're trying to get a sound out and you can't. Usually it's a Buddha, a ghost that's stopping you. Or the body hasn't fully integrated, the soul has fully integrated a subtle body into the physical body. So you can experience things in two different arenas. Now, once I was able to get the sound, then the being left. So you can interpret that in different ways. You can interpret it that entity was saying, are you really ready to go? And if you have to check in the material plane more, it's a sign that you're not really ready. Or you can interpret it that it was a message that when you're ready, we're ready to take you. Or a message that you're not alone. That there is, in the background, there is guides, there's assistance, there's facilitation, and that your guru and the Lord will arrange what is necessary and what is best at the best time. So all of this is just to introduce what we want to read today. We must die for ourselves. Our theme discussion today is we must die for ourselves. Just as you can't eat for me and I can't eat for you, you have to do your own sleeping. You know, up until just the last, 5-6 days, I hadn't slept for like 6 or 7 weeks. There was no question. At first, when the cancer was so deep in the leg, as we mentioned, sometimes the leg would shake every 15 to 20 minutes. And there were other complications. And then there was insomnia. And then the body got in a pattern of not being able to sleep for quite a while. So even when the amputation took place, still the cycle was there. And Krishna's mercy, that's changed. But also very interesting, because we can understand better what people go through who have chronic insomnia. Whew, unbelievable. We take yourself much for granted. And most devotees, as soon as they hit the bed, as soon as they hit the mat, they're out. Because we sleep so little sometimes, or we're so busy. And when we lay down, it's like even before we hit the mat, practically, we're already out. We wake up and then go to sleep. But there are millions of people who can't sleep, who can't get a peaceful night of sleep. This is just basic things. So somebody else sleeping is not going to make their sleep easier. I remember many days being upstairs and I hear Ekavir snoring, sometimes rather a little bit, Madhava. I'm thinking, but what about me? You know, it's like everybody, it's like you're at a banquet and everyone's eating and you can't eat and you just have to watch them. So there are very significant things that we have to do ourselves. And nobody can do them for us. And some of the most important things in our life, even though we get training, even though we are exposed in group, in sangha, in community, but in the final analysis, we have to go solo. Just as the group of musicians in a concert and they're practicing together, and then one has to do solo. Now he or she comes up to the microphone, and now this is them. This is their chance to show what they know or to become bewildered. Now one of the things about solo, if you're not really strong about what you have learned, if it's not really a part of you, when you have to go solo, sometimes the fear and the anxiety causes one, you know, to lose it. Even though you can know something, but if you only know it at a certain level, when you have to do it by yourself, by being so nervous, it can cause you to make a mistake. And if you really know it at a deeper level, even though you get really nervous, it's so much of a part of you, it just comes out and it happens. So the moments of death is also like that. Is that so much we prepare for it, but unless the consciousness is of such a depth that even though we are trained and we hear every day that we are not these bodies, and Krishna tells us very clearly not to worry and not to fear. Sarva dhamma parati yajna mami kam savanam braja aham tam papapayo mokshi samima sucha. Krishna says, okay, even dharma, abandon it. Accept something higher, it's not the Dharma. Don't worry, don't fear. Even though you may be in the minority in what you do, what you accept, even though it may go directly assault against material nature and culture, don't worry. Because we're not alone. And we are helped, or will be helped, according to our level of surrender. So we have these guides and assistants also according to our level of surrender. Even the atheists have helpers available, but they're just more than not likely to take advantage. Even the neophyte. Just like, for instance, we hear the value of leaving the body in the holy dhams. And there's so many reasons for that. Because of the kind of leelas that have gone on, what is associated with the nama, the rupa, the guna, the leelas, nama, the name of the Lord is being chanted, the Lord making different types of appearances in his leela, different kinds of pastimes that go on there, etc. But also because special kinds of helpers associate in those particular environments. Now, not that one can only get that kind of help if they go to the holy dhams, but it is more accessible for everyone. According to one's quality, they will have certain kind of helpers that will be with them wherever they are. When Prabhupada was leaving India to come to the West, and he stressed several times, even before, that he wanted to die on the battlefield. Well, traditionally, one wants to leave the body in the holy dhams. And it's also a way to give more benediction and blessings to people who may not even have so many wonderful helpers, but by coming to such an environment, they're a little more available or accessible to get certain kind of help. But just as Krishna is not in one place, one yatra or one temple, even in one incarnation, we see that he is available pervasively. So that experience of seemingly my desire to leave was in many ways Krishna reminding me that, okay, if you really want to go, we can take you out, but know that you're not alone, even though it may seem to be that way. It's like a sannyasi is in trouble if he's lonely. He can be alone, but if he is lonely, he's in trouble. His sannyasi is to be questioned, and how long he will be able to remain is also very questionable. Because one is to be very alert about the fact that one is on a mission for Guru and for Krishna, and to always allow their instructions to vibrate in his consciousness, or if a woman is in a renounced state, in her consciousness. So many renounced women or widows also. But if one is lonely, then there is a suffering, and there is bewilderment, and there's also a lack of having sufficient interconnection that allows one, even when they are seemingly by themselves, to not to be only by themselves, but to be able to experience the divine associations. So we want to read briefly. We must die for ourselves. One way we define our existence is by what we offer to community, how we are valued and perceived by community, and how our participation in the community enhances our God consciousness. Normally we begin by getting nurtured by our families. We attend different schools, join clubs and organizations. We associate with like-minded people. We attend social, cultural, political, and religious functions. In other words, so much of who we are, what we do, and who and what we are becoming is based on our associations or in the communities that we connect with. However, the most amazing thing is that although we are social beings and are evaluated by others, ultimately the most important things in our lives we must do ourselves. Others cannot do them for us. And sometimes not only must we do them for ourselves, we must do them alone. Grandfather Bhishma talks about this, how, you know, at the end of one's life, only Dharma follows you. That only the reactions, the results from what you did or what you didn't do, everyone else will turn their back on you. I mean, not that they'll forget about you, hopefully, but they turn their back on you because you get buried, you get cremated or whatever, and you gotta walk away at some point, however close they may be. Even if they want to die with you, in most cases they have to walk away. Or if they want to die for you. Death especially clarifies this for everyone. When the living entity takes birth, each soul makes a journey of connection through the birth canal. There are many helpers that visit us in the birth process. Some are mature and some are spiritual. Bhagavatam explains how the living entity, at some point while in the womb, has awareness of many, many lifetimes, and often has to reflect on, oh, I got to come back into this material world again. And higher beings decide and help to arrange what race, what gender, what family that one is going to enter into. Material bodies, eggs, and sperms are needed, of course, but also higher beings help determine the exact conditions the soul is to experience. Once all of these arrangements are in place, the living entity must be on his or her journey of maturation. Death especially clarifies this for everyone. The body, being a machine, needs proper care. When it is sick, there is a need for proper foodstuff, proper environment, proper herbs, proper medicine to assist with the restoration. The body also needs proper sleep. You see, I was writing this when I wasn't able to sleep. Without proper sleep, the body falls apart in so many ways. Just as one can take the medicines that are prescribed for us to restore our bodies, similarly, when our body experiences tiredness, no one else can take rest for us. Their sleeping will not restore our bodies. This is the same with our eating. No one can eat for you, for it is your body that needs the nourishment. So you're very hungry. Someone says, oh, no problem, I'll take care of it. what would you like? Sabji and samosas and pakoras. Okay, I'll eat them for you. That's not going to give you nourishment. Death especially clarifies this for everyone. Sometimes for school or for our job, we may have to take examinations. Usually these tests are given to see how much we know, how competent or expert we have become. These tests reveal our strengths as well, of course, as our weaknesses. The test is to bring clarity to us as well as for others, our exact status. We also take physical examinations to elevate and investigate the condition of our health. No one else can take your exam. No one else's exam scores or health analysis will substitute for yours. We must experience or have our own evaluations. If you need a physical, you can't send someone else who's in good shape and say, okay, so I'm in good shape. You need to get a shot. Huh? Some people may do that, though. You need to get a shot. You send someone else to get it in your name. They get the shot. But basically, one has to take their own, you know, their own medicine, their own examinations. Death especially clarifies this for everyone. Even a basic and mundane thing is going to the toilet. No matter how busy, absorbed, intelligent, powerful one may be, still when there is a serious call for elimination, when it descends on us, no one can permanently avoid or procrastinate the call. You can't, you're doing something and you're very busy and you feel the call to go ease yourself. You can't tell somebody else, I'm busy, go ease for me. No. Have to do even such basic things ourselves. Also, no one can call or solicit another to eliminate for him or her. Sometimes someone else's elimination will not influence our own passing. Death especially clarifies this for everyone. More basic is our breathing. We take thousands of breaths in one day's time. Most of us exhale and inhale mechanically, without any encumbrance or cognizance. However, if we lose ability to breathe for a few minutes, our life becomes in danger. Someone may lose ability to breathe for a few minutes. Someone or a machine may be used to aid us, you know, in our ability to restore our natural breathing. But ultimately, to continue with our healthy lives, we must be able to breathe ourselves. People can be on machines and can support them, but it's not considered to be a healthy existence. And at some point, it's expected that they should be able now to take over their own breathing. Even if those who love us are trying to save us and are breathing nicely, they cannot transfer their complete normal breath to us. Even someone, resuscitation, you're giving them breath, but you're really trying to get them to breathe on their own. Inevitably, they must do their own breathing as we must similarly do ours. Death especially clarifies this for everyone. The path of bhakti is to give up sinful life, to avoid unhealthy sense gratification. Each sadhaka aspiring devotee, that is, associates in the community of devotees, must make their own vows for fellowship and worship, must maintain their commitments, and perform their own devotional service. When we take initiation and we make our commitments, we do our vrats to follow the four rules and regulations, chant 16 rounds a day, etc., we have to do it ourselves. Each candidate comes up one by one. Even though it's understood what the other person said and everyone is aware, still each person has to come and say their particular vows. And no one can do it for us. Here again, each person must undergo their own test to reestablish their pure relationship with the divine couple, with Krishna, Radha, the Mother, Father, God. Each aspirant must individually convert or transform the lower tastes and involvements to higher tastes and transcendental activities. Friends, family members, and even mentors can pray, they can coach us, they can guide us, but still we must individually commit and involve ourselves in the process of Sharanagati, of surrender. Therefore, everything we read, hear, and see, remember, feel, and talk about, associate with, etc., should help us to work more expediently, individually, on our own spiritual acceleration. If our own quality is not improving, we will not only cheat ourselves, but we'll highly cheat others as well. Death especially clarifies this for everyone. A few more reflections. Just as each individual has his or own unique fingerprints, we're all individually unique in various ways. Even two twins, even two simultaneous, what do you call it, Siamese twins, they're still different in so many ways. Sometimes one is subjected to a routine operation. The doctor may not anticipate any complications, but the patient may develop many complications. Other times, by all rational scientific evaluation, the person has no chance of survival. However, the person may experience spontaneous remission and goes on to lead a life, a very normal, healthy life. We see in such cases that we all have an appointed time to die. Until that time is manifested, nothing can force it on us. And when that time does not come, no one can really check it. And the doctors told me 5.5 months ago that I had maybe 5 or 6 months to live if I didn't do anything. And I thought, yeah, okay, so it's good to know what the rational and normal considerations are. And even if that is the case, that's a long time, either to prepare for a glorious death or to change it around. It's 6 months and I'm still sitting here. Oh, I just fall over and I die. Uh-oh, what's Swami gone? He stayed for six months and 2 days. Death, especially, but we know that yogis could determine when to leave and leave just like that. Death especially reminds us how we are so different and unique. Death reminds us that we each have our own appointments and specific relationships with God. Our deaths are just as controlled by higher authorities just as much as our births. Nobody just appears. The birth is highly arranged. And it may seem like accident that sometimes the two people did not plan to bring that life, but planning was definitely there by higher authorities. And someone didn't plan to leave, but the plan was there. Yes, it is true that we are social beings who survive in community. It is through community we define ourselves and we awaken our dormant consciousness. And I end with these last points here. However, we must eat and sleep for ourselves, pass our own examinations, do our own breathing, do our own elimination, do our own sadhana, devotional service, and most important, we must do our own dying. Death especially clarifies this for everyone. I am that lowly beggar who is prepared to do his own dying. I thank the community of saints, of sadhus, for assisting me in getting prepared for this solo journey. Hare Krishna. So what we've talked about today is, normally we emphasize, you know, so much about Sangha, community, and why it's so important that we see ourselves as Dasu Dasono Dasu, servant of the servant. And you can't do that by yourself. It's hard to be the servant of the servant if there's nobody to serve. You can be the servant and you serve yourself. but to be the servant of the servant, you got to have a subject, you know, to be able to serve. And we talked about this Ishavasha principle that where normally people try to get everything and do everything for themselves and they trespass on others and not concerned about the benefit of others' well-being. But as Vaishnavas, we are to be very, very highly concerned. And even our own spiritual growth and desire to develop should be so much based on wanting to serve better. So in order to serve better, we need more refined facilities, more refined consciousness. As we have that kind of mood, then Krishna will facilitate us. Just as if you are CEO of a company, and someone working in your company is trying hard to work on behalf of that company, then what do? You give them more responsibility, you give them more opportunity, you give them more chance to do more things, seeing that they are more involved in trying to facilitate the success of that particular sangha or that particular community of activities. We talked about the fact that it's kind of a misnomer to say alone, because we're never really alone. Super soul is there. We're being watched by the sun, by the moon, by the devas. That we also have guides and assistants. But at the same time, there are periods in our life when we have to do solo. We get example of the singer or the musician or the sportsman. And those are really important times, because if we're not fully sufficiently integrated, or if our knowledge is not on a deep level, then we have to do solo. The fear, the anxiety that comes from knowing that everyone's looking at us or listening to us, or the fear of feeling alone, causes one to lose what they normally are aware of, or it causes them not to perform to the degree that they in fact could. But when we really internalize something on a deeper level, even when those kind of times come, we just kind of go through and do and perform nicely, because it's such a part of us. We don't even have to think so much about what we're doing. It just happens because it's become such an integral part, you know, of our actual existence. So when death comes, it's quite similar. Even when we're just, when we have a fever or we have something pretty bad on us, how difficult it is to chant and to read and to do just a normal, the normal sadhana. So when death comes, it's even more than that. Everything becomes difficult. So much of our faculties, they shut down. And if we are not sufficiently integrated, then there will be a problem. If we haven't sufficiently made our priorities, our devotional existence, then so many other things will kick in and will absorb our consciousness, will interfere with the soul being able to make its proper transition. That's why we have to be clear about our priorities. As we do so many things in the course of the day, we must be careful to make sure, are we putting these other things that are to be done, maintaining body and soul together, but are they replacing our sadhana? Are they more prominent in our consciousness than our service and surrender to Guru and Krishna? Are we working in our devotional activities as something extracurricular, or just only out of duty? And then this other stuff that we do is, our real nectar. Are we getting more stimulation from going to the movies, watching television, doing sports, doing games, joking frivolously or whatever? Not that one shouldn't be joyful, but also there should be some quality even to such joking. Are we experiencing more seemingly stimulation from such than we are from our devotional practice? And if so, we're in trouble, because that means so much of our consciousness is still based on the mundane. Not that we should hate the things that we have to do. We should do those also as an offering to Krishna. We dovetail. But even more important are the things that are directly a part of devotional culture, that there should be a taste and a desire to do more, and there should be a greater appreciation for such. And then, of course, I discuss about the how when the child is seemingly alone and frightened, how many of us we are so afraid, but we should remind ourselves, you know, that we're never alone. You mentioned about the experience, you know, in Hawaii, where I was, in one sense, thinking I was alone, making the prayer at the same time, being ready to go, but a reinforcement was there, is that, all right, it is not the time. At the same time, it is possible to take you at any moment. And at the same time, should know, you know, that you're not alone in this. Solo is significant. We all have different points in our lives when, you know, this is accessed. And we can say that all of these times that we are doing something in solo or alone, it's really preparation for the ultimate performance. When all the experiences and things we've read and things we've done now in the background, and then, like the mentor instructor says, okay, now go to the microphone, you know, and do your piece. So we come forth now and we have to present ourselves to Guru and Krishna. And our quality is evaluated to see where we go. So it's like life itself is performance, is a practice. And then one day the concert is there. And people at different times, you know, have their solo. And so we will be called upon, and we're called upon, and our position should be that we're excited and joyful to come forth and to show how much we have studied, how we've accepted the instruction of how to do and how to play and how to behave. And now we have chance, you know, we have chance to present ourselves. So we are, we'll be called upon, you know, to present ourselves. And each time we hear somebody leaving, or we're reflecting about more in our scriptures, or looking at or honoring appearance and disappearance days of the great, great saints, we should be thinking how they came into this world to expertly show us how we can also, you know, become great performers, and how we can do the solo, be able to be called back to the spiritual world, to the kingdom of God. Hare Krishna. Any questions or any comments? So it seems, you know, a little different. We talk about the importance of community and how everything should be done, not just based on individuality or egocentricity. How this is material paradigm and cosmology. One may need to think of him or herself. But we realize that institutions and community are healthy to the degree that they help the individual to be able to do his or her work or performance. You want to show? And then Mike. Hold the microphone.
When you said that we have to do things on our own, like sometimes when we realize that there is nobody out there who can help me, we tend to like withdraw ourselves from others. So when we realize we have to do everything ourselves, how can we still maintain loving relationship with devotees and feel that they are still important and nice to have a relationship with them?
Yeah, keep in mind, I said there's an appearance of being alone. The most important things we have to do, we have to do our share, we have to do ourselves. But we can do things for ourselves nicely based on the fact that we've done things with others with quality. The sportsman can perform nicely when he gets the baton based on the fact that he's practiced nicely with others. And so therefore, when it's his chance, he has to do that individually. It's got to be influenced by how he's trained or how he's associated in that way. So no, this is not a class to emphasize, you know, do your own stuff. Yeah, you heard Maharaj, he said, you know, real community is you do your own thing. You know, don't get disturbed by what other people think. You know, just do what you have to do. You know, be real. Have your identity. Yes, but our real identity is, you know, is a part of how we impact on others and how we serve others. Any other question? But, you know, because that is a major way that people are thinking, you know, these days. To just be honest and be real and just do what you have to do, you know. Don't be so disturbed of what people think or what they want. You have to live your life. And this kind of situational ethics and relativity and thinking is destroying the world, because it's an assault on community. It's a direct attack on valuing others. And it's the kind of consciousness that says that everybody and everything is there for, you know, for you to lord over. And just be tactful how you do it so people don't know you're lording over them. You know, and get and do what you have to do. That kind of solo, people who live like that, who really live alone, even though when they're with people, they're just trying to get for themselves. Then when they have to do solo, they fall apart. Because they're not used to being supported and backed up by a team that then gives you empowerment and faith to perform when you have to perform alone. See, many times when people have to perform alone, so much of their strength comes from knowing that others have and are still encouraging them. So even though they have to do it alone, they're also reflecting they don't want to disappoint those who are connected with them, and they're thinking their own success will be the success of others. So they're thinking, I don't want to blow my part, it's going to take away from the success of those who are backing me up and in many cases have done their part, have struggled or done well. I don't want to throw in an anchor into the whole thing, you know, and cause a disturbance. So that makes them even more attentive, even though they're frightened and afraid, nervous, but they're thinking, others have done solo, we have practiced together, others will do also have their chance. Let me now take my moment and do the best that I can for the benefit of everyone. Other questions? Let me take the first question first. Yes, there were times when Srila Prabhupada would tell us, I'm an old man, I can leave any day. I was reading the Gita Nagariya passage where Prabhupada was saying, I am already dead, so things should go on and do this, do that. And sometimes he would say how we are young and he's old, and so we should make sure that we carry on, etc., etc. Or at times that he would say that he's just waiting, you know, waiting to retire. So I was listening just the last few days to some tapes by Tamal Krishna Goswami, who was Prabhupada's secretary, you know, during those last months and last hours and days. And he was saying, interesting how Prabhupada would say that he just wanted to retire. But he said Prabhupada didn't retire into 2 hours, you know, before he left the body. Yesterday evening I was doing a recording. The devotees in Europe with the BBT asked me to share some inspirational words on a video that will show in Mayapur for the GBCs and the BBT coming together. So for some reason they called upon me just to offer some encouraging words about the distributing of Prabhupada's books. And so in that discussion, I was talking about how much Prabhupada was representing his guru, how Prabhupada had told Bhavananda and a few other devotees he didn't want to come into this world, but Krishna encouraged him to come and to write books, and that he would help him. But then I concluded by mentioning how not only did Prabhupada come into the world, and one of his main commissions and responsibilities in this universe was to write transcendental books, we see that Prabhupada's last activities is that there he is, completely body completely devastated, and he's lying on his back and the microphone is there and he's, you know, giving the purports of his books. So from his entrance into his closure, that he was fixed in this service. So in this way, Prabhupada was saying that, yes, I can go any time. But we see that Krishna was totally controlling his life. And then I was sending, we were showing some communications on the GBC conference, a very intimate exchanges Prabhupada sometimes had. And Prabhupada, as Vaishnavas do not so much reveal their internal bhajan. But there were a point when Prabhupada said how his spiritual master had appeared to him several times. And once how Rupa Goswami and Jiva Sisanat, I think, or Rupa Sanatana, maybe Jiva also, had appeared, and how they were instructing him and encouraging him. And then there's this wonderful book, you know, by Zamula Prakriti, his Kopa Vrindapal's wife, my god sister, who passed some months ago of cancer. And she went all around for quite some time and interviewed so many sadhus and acharyas, sipujaris, who knew Srila Prabhupada before he came to the West. And it's just awesome. And we don't have time now, but I shared two of the stories in the book, just showing the intensity of how Prabhupada, you know, prepared himself. Some of you saw the letter I sent out asking Prabhupada to let me stay for another year. It had such an impact in reading that, of to the degree that Prabhupada struggled, prayed, lived with such austerity to get the mercy and blessings to carry out this seemingly, you know, impossible task. You know, I think most of you read. I'll just give you one short story. One of the pujaris, who was a pujari for the temple, you know, next to Radha Damodar, named Hridayananda Baba Maharaj, who was born in Vrindavan, and he said, you know, he's lived his whole life in Raj, and he never met anyone who had the kind of sadhana that Srila Prabhupada had. He said he would hear so often, almost every night, someone just wailing and crying. So he said one day he climbed up on the roof and looked in at Radha Damodar temple in the courtyard, and he saw Prabhupada with a broom sweeping in the middle of the night around 12, 1 o'clock, and just crying out, you know, to Rupa Goswami, "Hey Rupa, you know, hey Sanat, you know, please help me." It's just unbelievable. The intensity of how Prabhupada was preparing himself. You know, so some of the sadhus talking how when they met Prabhupada, he just had a, you know, just a tattered blanket, and he was living, you know, so austerely. Let me tell you this last story also, that shows how, you know, his amazing connection that we all are sharing the benefits from. Another story was from the pujari of the Advaita Acharya temple, Mandir. This is where Lord Nityananda, Lord Chaitanya, and Advaita would come together to organize plans for the Sankirtan movement. So that same place, that same house, Advaita Acharya's house, Prabhupada would go there on a regular basis. And the pujari, when Mula Prakriti interviewed him, said that Prabhupada would come and he would just sit in the back for hours and just chant and just sob and cry. And then after spending hours of chanting, he would come and just thank the pujari and leave. But the pujari said he never would talk to him because he saw that Prabhupada was very kind of to himself and his bhajan. He didn't want to disturb his bhajan. He purposely, you know, was sitting in the back. Then he said one day Prabhupada came after quite a while, and you know, now he was in the sannyas dress, and he did the same thing but was crying and sobbing even more in the back of the temple. Then he came up close for the darshan and then spoke to the pujari. And once again, he thanked him. And this time they had a little conversation. So Prabhupada told the pujari, I promise I won't be crying anymore, right? that next day he was going to leave and go to America. And that is spiritual master giving him an impossible task. So he was praying that, he was thanking the Bajoria and praying that this rather impossible task that you give me, going to the West and having to deal with all of this Kali Yuga aspects. That yes, impossible, but not improbable. That by the mercy of Guru and Krishna, it can happen. So unbelievable what Prabhupada, how he prepared himself, what he tolerated, and what he gave. And you know, some of us who do a little traveling, we know how hard it is, huh? And just imagine an elderly gentleman in the shape that he was in, coming to the West, not knowing anybody, not having any sufficient money or contacts, and preparing to start a worldwide movement in just, you know, such a short time. But this is the kind of legacy that you know that we have. That we should never think that anything that is to be done is impossible. Or we should never really feel alone, even though we have to do solo. We should know that, you know, facilitation is there and blessings is there. And last, we should also know that there's a price for everything. So that as we enter into deeper and deeper levels of Krishna consciousness, we have to drop off a lot of gross and subtle things. As we prepare ourselves, when that person goes out and performs solo, but now they got the whole orchestra, you know, behind them, giving their blessings and prayers. So when Prabhupada came, he came alone. It's like you see this picture here. He's alone, seemingly. But nevertheless, he said he never felt separation from his spiritual master. And then we see that even the Goswamis were giving their blessings. And as is explained in the Chaitanya Mangala, how, and Lord Chaitanya mentions himself, as Prabhupada is the Senapati Bhakta, the Mantra Upasaka, that there will be one who literally will be this, like a transcendental bounty hunter, and will leave the shores of the land of Bhadvarsa, and will literally travel throughout the world, and being able to reclaim souls. Lord Chaitanya himself said that he would be spreading, he would spread Yuga Dharma throughout India. And there would later come one who would do this on such a large scale. So Srila Prabhupada was predicted even before he took birth. So this was, and then we hear Bhakti Vinod talking about this in his Santoshino magazine, how this time would come when sadhus from all over the world would come and chant the holy name, and therefore there would be someone who would be responsible, you know, for doing that. And so, and then Bodhisiddhanta had mentioned he will do what is necessary. See, Prabhupada was vanaprastha for some time, and he was associating, taking a very humble position with the other sannyasis of the math, and he was kind of almost like an outsider, so to speak. But very austere and very focused on what he had to do. At the right time, proper time, based on the guidance, instructions, then he left. And so these rather intimate stories were an ongoing part of Prabhupada's life, but Srila Prabhupada was very much trying to show us what is to be done. As any great acharya does, they take on more human-like qualities in order to encourage us what is to be done so that we can try. How he struggles so much in so many ways, like seemingly an ordinary person. But that's to help us to see what is possible based on our own situation. These great souls just did everything so easily. Then our own struggles, we would feel it's impossible for us to become Krishna conscious. When we see how they went to different ashrams, there were economic problems, health problems, so many different things, then we realize, oh, okay. So it's also possible that someone can become fully Krishna conscious. So let us get ready for our own solos, that we're not alone, But there are times when we have to put up, we have to perform based on what we should have learned. There are times when that's going to be most prominent, and that's at the time of death, when everything that we have gathered from the aggregate association of devotees, the reading of the scriptures, everything that we have received in terms of, you know, of our blessings, now it comes and it becomes resultant in, you know, directs the soul. Is confounded child, his divine grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Sri Prabhupada ki, Gopi Mananda Hari 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 Bhav. Bhakti Chaitanya Maharaj ki.